Hi, my name is Matt. I'm the founder of Regeneration Projects, a small business that sees two great bays and a river as our most important business partners. We started at a kitchen table during Melbourne's epic COVID-19 lockdown, and now we're a B Corp and actor in the UN decade on ecosystem restoration. As we begin this episode, we'd like to acknowledge the two great bays, Port Phillip and Western Port, which are known to First Peoples as Nam and Wurrumbirrin, or Murrumbik. Without the bays and the Birrarung Yarra River, we wouldn't be in business today. So we show deep respect to First Nations elders, past and present, who for over 60,000 years have cared for the bays, Birrarung, and their catchment areas. Their ecological knowledge inspires us to practice business in partnership with nature. Now, choosing a career that tackles environmental issues like climate change, biodiversity loss, or pollution can be incredibly rewarding, but also super tough. When we listen to the stories of passionate and pioneering professionals, it stokes our inner fire and belief so that we can keep doing the work that we know needs to be done to benefit future generations. That's what the Two Bays podcast is all about. Stories of hope, grit, and determination, inspiring the planet's next generation of ecological leaders and entrepreneurs. This series is made in partnership with the Mornington Peninsula Shire Council and celebrates the stories of business and community champions at the forefront of local climate action. Let's tune in. Womanjika, welcome to another episode of the Two Bays podcast. My name's Matt Sykes, and along with Claire Wild, we are ready to take another step on this virtual journey around the Mornington Peninsula, meeting champions in business and community that are embedding climate action into their day-to-day work. Today, we're meeting Beata Molliere, the Packaging and Product Stewardship Lead at the Boomerang Alliance, working both here on the Mornington Peninsula, but also in different parts of Australia and the world. Before we kick off, we'll take a moment to acknowledge those connections to country. On this particular podcast, we'll be circling around themes of waste and the circular economy and how we make that transition. So it feels very fitting to just honour those Boomerang and Bunurong connections to country, in particular those links with the two bays. When I would go down for a walk down to Port Phillip Bay, or Nerm, yeah, as it's known in First Nations language, one of the things that I see is the remnants of cultural spaces, living places, or you might know them as middens. And we'll see the shells that mark, you know, past meals and gatherings that families and clan groups would have had along there. And it always strikes me the way that that organic material is brought so close to where it came from, and then those nutrients then flow back down into the place to close that loop. And unlike the plastics, the cigarette butts, the plastic bottles that we might see commonly on Mornington Peninsula beaches, unfortunately perhaps too common, those things really do feel like they belong to place. So there's a lot that we can learn from those First Peoples, their culture and their living connections to country through elders past and present. So just really paying homage to those links. Beata, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the Two Bays podcast. And I'm really curious as an opener here to hear from you the way that Mornington Peninsula lifestyles are set up. There's a really close connection with nature. Why do you think that makes us a little bit more aware or tuned in of what's happening in terms of climate change?
Thanks so much, Matt, for that wonderful introduction. It's great to be here. Look, I, as you can probably tell by my accent, I'm actually not from here originally. So I have, at some stage, I moved here from Germany, and that's quite some time ago, and I moved to lots of different parts of the world in between. So being here on the Mornington Peninsula, I feel very privileged that we've got this incredible region that I now call home. And I do believe that, you know, looking at a lot of the other places where I have lived in the past, that what makes this area so special is that we've got the incredible links to our coast and also to our hinterland and bushland areas. So it is a very different region to the, for example, urban landscapes where I've lived, and I think that's where you do bring in that incredibly close connection to nature and to our natural assets.
Thanks so much, Beata. I'd love to hear from your perspective how the Boomerang Alliance came to be, and also how your work contributes to that sort of overall vision that you've just spoken about.
Thanks, Claire. So I do wear a few different hats, and I do run my own business, and I consult with local businesses, and I now also work with Boomerang Alliance, which you just mentioned, a national nonprofit, and we work to reduce waste and litter and really shift Australia to a circular economy. The idea really being that waste is not something that we've ever really considered as necessary, and it's a design fault. So what we need to do is shift to an economy, in particular when we're talking to businesses, that embraces resources to become more circular, where they're reused again and again.
Yeah, Beata, I just love to pick up on that, the term you used, circular economy. I know that gets talked about quite a lot, and for some of our listeners, that might be a new term. I'd love to hear from your perspective what that means to you and your work, and maybe if there's a sort of simple way of describing what the circular economy even is.
Absolutely. It's actually very simple. It means that we're shifting from a model where we are taking resources, using them once and then discarding them. And often what's happened in the past is that we've been discarding them and they go straight to landfill or they become littered. So instead of doing that, which is a very outdated model, is that we use every resource as something really precious, and that we keep in mind that we have only very finite resources across the planet, and that we use those resources again and again. So rather than becoming a disposed model, which we've had in the past, that we are now shifting to circular, where all resources will be kept in the loop for a very long time. And then once we're done with resources, they can be returned to Earth or to the ocean without causing any harm.
Yeah, it's funny, Beata, reflecting on the way that you describe the circular economy. This reminds me of a few conversations that we've had while we've been recording the Two Bays podcast, which is that often the guests that we're very lucky to have on the podcast who talk about their work describe the way they see their purpose and the impact that they have, like the way that you've described described the circular economy, is something that's inherently very logical and makes a lot of sense and isn't really rocket science. And it's I find it always a really interesting reflection to think about how society has got ourselves into this kind of predicament where we need to be coming up with concepts like the circular economy as if we're inventing them from scratch, where the way you've just described it makes so much sense, and you wonder why hasn't it always just been this way, and how did we get off track in the first place?
Yes, and I keep saying that it's actually not a new concept as such. If we look back, there have been so many ways of living circular. It's really much more a recent phenomenon that we've had this disposed model. And we need to go back to some of our old ways of just looking at everything as a precious resource, where we don't just go, oh, we're done with that and let's move on to the next item, and where things can't be repaired. So we need to really just go back to some of our old ways in that respect. And I always try to explain it in really simple ways, because when I talk and engage with a lot of businesses and individuals, it's often sounding like an incredibly complex topic, but it's not. So if we just break it down to some really simple steps and what everyone and every business can do in this space, then it becomes much more doable for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes so much sense.
Yeah.
On that note, I'd be really interested to hear, and again, maybe this is something that is actually really simple, even though sometimes we think it's a bit tricky, that connection between the circular economy and climate action. I'd love to hear if you have a perspective on how those two things are related.
Yes, I think it's at the moment in Australia, the connection between circular economy and climate is not that well known. And when we look globally, I think there's a lot more evidence already that there's a huge connection between waste, for example, and how that impacts on climate. So looking across a range of different streams in terms of our resources, for example, when we look at food waste and that going to landfill, has a huge impact on climate. So when we are not reducing and when we're not using our resources carefully, it actually does have a big impact on our climate. And another aspect, which I know you wanted to touch on, is plastics and packaging. So again, the footprint of those sorts of materials that we're using at the moment very excessively, it's huge. And we are, again, not really considering that much in the packaging landscape at the moment in this country. So the connection is there. It's really just around the awareness and making sure that we can bring some of that information to our people.
Yeah, Berta, maybe for this next question, there might be a couple of examples that you could share, particularly around packaging waste and plastic that you've talked about.
Yeah.
Maybe even touching on sort of awareness raising as well. I'd love to hear about any examples of work that you've done to really help that transition towards the circular economy.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the programs we're running locally on the Mornington Peninsula is called Plastic Free Places. And what we're doing with Plastic Free Places is work with local business owners, so predominantly hospitality venues and also events and at times schools, where we are shifting from single-use takeaway packaging to reuse bottles, which means let's just not have all these single-use items that pretty much 99% of those are actually going to landfill at the moment and are not being recycled. So shifting away from that single-use dispose model to reusables. And where that's not possible straight away, we look at some alternative avenues and alternative materials that don't have the same heavy footprint. We've worked with a whole range of different organisations and businesses on the peninsula to get them to look at their own takeaway packaging range. And going forward, are now taking to the next level where it's more about a peninsula-wide reuse model when, you know, you start looking at individual items such as coffee cups, for example. And that's one of those where it's very straightforward. We all have a reusable cup in our cupboards, and it's about dusting those off and making sure that we understand what the impact of one of those tiny little items can be. If we look at the figures nationally and internationally of coffee cups alone and the connection to climate, it's actually really significant, and it's one of those small changes that everyone can make quite easily.
Yeah, Berta, and in terms of making those small changes, I'm really curious to hear how easy or difficult it has been for people in the community to get involved in this. For example, is, you know, shifting to more reusable ways of living, is that something people are finding easy? Is it something that is a bit inconvenient? I'd be really interested to know.
Look, we actually were going very, very well on the peninsula before COVID, particularly with things like coffee cups. And during the pandemic, we've had obviously a bit of a scare around, oh, you know, is it safe? Can I take it to my venue? Can I take it to my cafe? So there's been a lot of misinformation during that time. And that's what we are now still finding in some places, that, you know, there's been this situation around, you know, safety of reusables. But apart from that and the convenience side of things, once you start to introduce the bigger picture around a single-use coffee cup, it's often just one of those aha moments. And those we work with are very happy to jump on board and make that one of their changes. So I think it is often really around the lack of awareness what one of these items does in terms of impact. And then once people are and become more aware, it's something that they shift pretty quickly. That's certainly what we've learned. So with this program, Plastic Free Places, it's been running across Australia in lots of different communities. And we've really seen behaviour change across the board, and we are now talking with a whole range of stakeholders who are also looking to simply say no more to single-use coffee cups, so that even governments are now saying, you know, that's one of those items that we don't need. Can we actually just added to our banned item list. So there's a lot more awareness now, and we've done a lot of work since COVID to address some of those concerns. And slowly then with this one item, we can shift the conversation to some of the other items as well, whether it's water bottles or plastic bags. And again, they all come with a massive footprint when it comes talking about climate. So each of those, tackling one by one, is going to be really important for us when we look at plastic contributing to climate.
Yeah, Peter, listening to what you're sharing there kind of reminds us of how our daily habits and actions can have, you know, some significant cumulative impacts. Like, we all love coffee, or many of us love coffee, but, you know, that action of like going to get your morning coffee or your afternoon coffee or your evening coffee or how many other coffees you have in a day, we don't actually realize, you know, and it is good to see more compostable coffee cups and so on, but it seems like there's just a bit of a fundamental aspect in what you're sharing that, you know, taking your own coffee cup and managing that, as well as your own bags to when you're going shopping or taking your own water bottle, there's this almost like a custodianship or a responsibility that it's not really a responsibility. It's like what Claire was saying, it's just kind of like, you know, a thing you do. But at the same time, that can be challenging. And there's two things that jump out in relation to the Mornington Peninsula. You know, the peninsula is a place where you've got an aging population, and so there's certainly dynamics between certain generational differences. My mum talks about, you know, going to, you know, takeaway places back in the day, and you take your own containers, whereas, you know, now it's quite different. But I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on some of those generational dynamics that are part of your work. And the other one is that difference between visitors to the peninsula and locals on the peninsula, and how, I guess, we can work together towards these goals, but sometimes that also might present its challenges. So, yeah, just those intergenerational and also that visitation aspect of the peninsula that makes it unique in this space.
Matt, you're spot on. So we speak to a lot of people from other generations who think it's just about, you know, bringing back the good old days and not being as reliant as we are these days on single use, and really talking to, you know, the way that they were brought up, and that this is just one of those things that it was a short phase where we were ultra reliant on single use plastics, and that we are shifting back to what many consider the good old days in that respect. We do at the same time also hear from a lot of the really young generations who are being brought up in schooling systems where it's, you know, day in, day out, they hear about waste reduction. They do learn about circular economy at primary school at this point. So there's all these young people coming through with a real appetite to make change. And so when we are able to give these young people the right tools and a mechanism to really drive change, then they become our best ambassadors. And that's most definitely what I've seen. So basically across all age groups and all age levels, there's that appetite for change. And there's always some who won't be jumping on board. But what I always say is, once you have a movement around these sorts of things, then there's enough of us to actually change the norm around, you know, what do we want to see and what is okay, that's where we will start seeing that real shift. So from my perspective and what I've seen working with lots of organizations, businesses and individuals, it's across the board that you can get a lot of supporters for this topic, and a lot of frustration as well in the community around really wanting to see the change. So that's, you know, things like, as you would know, the soft plastics debacle, when we all of a sudden started realizing it wasn't being as recycled as we all thought it was. So there's huge awareness in the community around those sorts of issues, and people want change and they want things to be done properly and done well. So I would say it's not so much than an age question. It's more about those who are aware and they want to see change, and once they see the avenues and opportunities, they are on board. And then in terms of visitors and locals, again, I think it often comes down to where people may be coming from. So what we do see, for example, is with reusable water, when you come from countries where drinking water is not safe, and then for us to be able to go, hey, you know, our tap water is fine. Please choose tap. So then at that point in time, we might encounter some barriers. But it's really around understanding some of that cultural background and those different situations that people may have been living in, and looking at how we can address those. So there's some small nuances in that respect where we need to be really aware around certain barriers and tackle those specifically.
Just as you were talking about the soft plastics, it took me straight back to when I first met my fiance, and I had a practice of collecting the soft plastics and, you know, would wash them and even put them out on the, you know, the washing line to dry, and then they'd go into that system. And how devastated I was when, you know, we found out that, you know, and I don't know the full story, but my interpretation was that, you know, they were being put in a shed or some kind of storage system, and then not actually being fed as a useful material into that, you know, that next life. So it was kind of not cradle to cradle. It wasn't kind of cradle to grave. It was somewhere in between. But, you know, it was something that was, it was achievable, and recycling is one of those things that we feel is achievable. Before we move on, because there's a couple of threads that, that as you were just expanding then, two that come to mind. One is, you did mention that you come from Europe, and we have this image of, you know, Europe, Germany, the Nordics being, you know, so far ahead and having all these different systems. Curious to hear your reflections about what you do see back in the, you know, the Northern Hemisphere, in some of those places you're connected to, and how that's different to what we might experience in our own backyard.
Yes, sure. And I also want to answer your question about soft plastic situation. So, Matt, even when we still had RedCycle in our supermarkets, we only ever recycled about 4% of all soft plastic that was produced. So it was sold as this incredible solution that all our supermarkets were offering. And a lot of us were, you know, very diligently washing and drying and then taking soft plastics into the stores. But even at that point in time, it was only over 4%, and all the business soft plastics that wasn't recycled didn't get counted. So we never really had a well-functioning system that then broke down. It was always a system that didn't work, and then all of a sudden we all saw that it wasn't working. So it was just not out in the open, and it had to come out so we could actually now go, okay, it's not working. Let's actually have a really good look at what would work. One of the biggest challenges for us in Australia is to reduce how much we're using in the first instance. So when you look at some international research, what we will unfortunately see is that we're globally leading in the use of single-use plastics. So being, you know, having world records is always amazing, but not when it comes to this space. So we are one of the top users. Apart from Singapore, we're actually the second highest user of single-use plastics. And that's something that we need to tackle. So when we then look at Europe, for example, they are further ahead when it comes to product stewardship around packaging. And we need to learn a lot of the lessons from elsewhere and not reinvent the wheel. Most definitely, it is about shifting to circular. It is about reducing how much we use in the first place and getting our systems right and being able to use some recycled materials really well. What we don't want to see is that we just use things once and then we incinerate, for example. That's what some countries do. That's not a solution, because when you talk again about climate, we don't want to create that one use and then have no more access to that resource, and that's not part of a circular economy. So when we look across to Europe, yes, there's so much to learn, and there's also some areas where we go, no, we won't do that. We can actually, as Australia, be globally leading in this space, and we have that unique opportunity to really drive that reform. The federal government is very keen to make that happen, so there's a lot of change happening at the moment with a reform agenda coming out. There will be more information about it in May, where the general public will also be invited to join in. So I see that as a really big opportunity for Australia to take the lead in this space.
Well, let's make that happen. That sounds like a good silver lining, because I was kind of losing a little bit of hope there, in the sense that, you know, you mentioned that we were doing this and we were chipping in and contributing our part, and we were still only getting to 4%. But I think the way you talk about gumming upstream into the way that products and services are designed is, it feels like it has a lot of potential. So what if we could just dive onto that, and then we'll loop back to Claire. If we were to look at some of the commercial advantages of using circularity in business and eliminating, eliminating waste, literally designing it out of the system, what are a couple of examples that make sense on a Mornington Peninsula context, where whether it's the local cafe or the restaurant or how we get around, what's something that shows the power of contributing to the circular economy and therefore that having climate benefits, as well as it being beneficial to the operations of a business?
Yeah, let me talk to Plastic Free Places again as an example. So where we are able to shift local venues to reusables and reduce their waste, there's a couple of things in terms of cost savings, and that's one of the big benefits to businesses. So once you start reducing your landfill, and once you start to reduce your packaging costs, that's actually a really big saving to your operations. And that's one of those areas that we get asked about a lot by our businesses, especially now that all costs are going up. So once they see how much can be saved in packaging costs and landfill costs, that becomes a no-brainer from a business perspective. What we also see, though, is very different, and that is around a new consumer or a new customer and increased ability to retain customers who are much more aware of what's going on, and people who want to make sure that the business they frequent, that they're actually doing the right thing. So that is what we see as well with a lot of our businesses, that there's with certain it's a growing customer base, but with certain customer groups, there's really that awareness and expectation that a business does do the right thing, so that it becomes part of their branding, it becomes part of their storytelling, and it becomes then part of something that they can use to really grow a community locally with their customers. So it becomes not just a business transaction, but they're building community around doing the right thing. What we're also seeing is that it ultimately benefits local regions, because once you start to create local circular loops, you're working with businesses that are within your region rather than sourcing from, let's say, interstate or overseas. So all of a sudden you're benefiting other families in our regions, and you are creating a much closer loop in that respect. And that's where other businesses can also thrive, really just by looking at creating a local circular economy. And we know a lot of business networks that have just really started to work on how do we create this local network and look at benefits for each other and look out for each other. So it's not only about climate, it's also about building local community and those local broader benefits for our businesses.
I love, I've really, really enjoyed listening to this conversation and reflecting on the fact that when we started this podcast today, I was thinking I'm going to learn about some new, you know, interesting technologies or solutions when it comes to the circular economy. And I think, again, as with so many areas of sustainability, we've got the technology. The business case is there. Beata, as you just mentioned, so much of the circular economy makes absolute business sense when it comes to like a commercial financial perspective. And so much of it comes down to education, awareness raising, behavior change, just encouraging people to use the solutions that we already have. And it's been really wonderful to hear your reflections on how you're doing that in the Mornington Peninsula, and also in, you know, the visitors to the area, and also thinking about how that could affect the broader community and even the globe. And with the benefit of hindsight, I'd love to sort of rewind right back to the start of your climate action journey, and you can go as far back as you want. If you could give yourself just a couple of pieces of advice for your earlier self, I'd love to hear what those might be.
Look, interesting question, Claire, because I actually started my climate journey when I was a child, and it was walking on a beach in Germany, not here, where I saw a pretty devastating environmental disaster. At that point in time, I did realize that there was a whole lot going wrong, and I sort of, you know, obviously not consciously at that point in time, but I did at that point in time make the decision that I wanted to do something in the environmental space and contribute positively rather than creating more issues for what might happen to. So I saw wildlife being quite heavily impacted. And so I made those decisions unconsciously really early. So I started cleaning up beaches when I was about 11, 12. And I did all these things, writing to the German Chancellor and things like that. So thinking about what would I have told myself back then is, at times I felt quite, and this goes, obviously, it's a long time ago. So at times I felt quite isolated in my pursuit, so thinking, you know, it's only me, nobody else is doing anything. So when I talk to young people now, my biggest advice is always back yourself, and there's so many of us now really aware and looking to drive change. And I also think it's about making sure that you don't look at a complex situation and don't know and think about how, you know, don't overcomplicated and, you know, try and break it down too much. Because if we start with one change, and if everyone can just take that advice around, you know, what is one thing that I can do rather than being overwhelmed by global issues, I think we will all be much better off. So I think that overwhelm is what I also experienced as a young person, and that's what I hear a lot at the moment. So really being able to break it down and is there one thing I can do, and making sure that you share the responsibility. So when I was young, I felt like I had this big burden on my shoulders. But it is important to remember that we share this burden. It's not one person. It's a collective responsibility. We are all custodians. It's not just one of us. And I encourage everyone to be part of the journey and do their bit rather than leaving it to a few who might be scientists, who might be environmental experts. I think it's really important to remember that we can all do our bit and not to get too overwhelmed.
Yeah, I think that reflection of beginning your climate journey as a child is, I wonder if it's quite common. It's certainly an experience that I share.
Yeah.
And I think it comes back to that idea of how often I find that as children, both as adults looking back at their own selves as children, and also as hearing what children today are saying, there seems to be this inherent understanding of what sustainability and regeneration really means and what it means to be a custodian of the planet. And yes. Often yep. We seem to go through this sort of unlearning yep. process where somewhere along the way we get a little bit lost. And we move to things like those linear systems and, you know, that idea of endless growth and consumption and all those sorts of things, and sort of coming back to that and better, as you said, in a way that makes you feel like you're connected to a community around you and you're not in it alone, and that there are roles that all of us can play and that this will be a collective effort, I think is such a powerful thing. I might hand back to Matt now to round out the episode. Thanks again, Berta. It's been so wonderful hearing from you.
Thank you, Claire. Yeah, I've that image of a young Berta walking along a German beach and, you know, obviously being confronted with something that moved you quite deeply, but left an imprint that has you now walking along beaches and seeing the world in a very particular way. It's quite a powerful image, you know, to think about perhaps even visitors that might be heading down to the Mornington Peninsula in the coming weekend, and, you know, that young person having learnt or been exposed to some things on school or social media and wondering, you know, what's my part in this, and thinking about literally what they put in their bag. You know, is it a keep cup? Is it a water bottle? Is it a, you know, reusable bag that they can use? even a bag to pick up litter if they were heading down to the beach. But those simple tools in the right hands being a way to kind of really mobilize someone, and that really catching fire across generations. So thank you, Beata, for sharing your story as well as some of your technical and industry and knowledge, because it helps us bring this to life so much. You know, when we started the episode talking about waste and circular economy, similar to you, Claire, I wasn't sure where we might go, because it can become very technical very quick, but so much of it seems to be linking back to the human dimension and, you know, where we're at in this intergenerational cycle. And it would be, it'd be amazing if the peninsula can really lead and take a step up as part of Australia's next steps in this work, because, we don't want to be left behind. We want to be kind of chipping in locally, but also putting ourselves on the map internationally. So on that note, Beata, thank you so much for sharing your work at the Boomerang Alliance. And to all those people for joining us, thank you for tuning in to the Two Bays podcast from Claire and myself. Until next time, we'll see you soon. Cheers. How amazing are those Mornington Peninsula climate champions? Must be something in the water. Against the odds, they're transforming climate anxiety into climate action. Keep your eyes out for new episodes coming soon. So you're feeling inspired and ready to act. What can you do next? Firstly, subscribe to the Two Bays podcast on your favorite channel. Then visit the Regeneration Project's website for more info about our ecological leadership and strategic consultancy work. Lastly, don't forget to follow Regeneration Projects on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn, as well as subscribe to our seasonal newsletter. My name is Matt, and on behalf of Regeneration Projects and the Two Bays, thank you for tuning in, and see you on the next episode of Two Bays, a Business and a Kitchen Table podcast.